From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young in Boston.
I'm Peter O'Dowd in Phoenix. This is Here and Now. The House committee investigating the January 6th attack turns its focus today on the state officials who protected the results of the 2020 election. Lawmakers will lay out Donald Trump's effort to pressure local officials from states like Georgia and Arizona to subvert the vote count. We're expecting to hear from Arizona's Republican Speaker of the State House and the top election official from Georgia. Let's bring in Stephen Fowler, political reporter with Georgia Public Broadcasting. Stephen, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
And that official I'm referring to is Brad Raffensperger, Georgia's Secretary of State, a Republican who received this now infamous phone call just days before the January 6th attack. Here's Trump pressuring Raffensperger to find votes that did not exist.
So, look, all I want to do is this. I just want to find 11,780 votes, which is one more than we have.
Stephen, remind us the context of this call and how the Secretary of State reacted to it.
Right. So Georgia was one of the closest elections in the 2020 presidential race. Trump lost by about 11,780 votes. And for weeks after the election, and even after Georgia had its votes counted three separate times, Trump and his allies refused to acknowledge that result and tried to find ways to overturn it. This culminated in this hour-plus call between Trump and Raffensperger January 2nd, 2021, just a couple days before important dual Senate runoffs, where Trump pressured Raffensperger and threatened, harassed, cajoled, tried to get him to find fraud with absentee ballots and reverse the results.
He obviously did not do that.
Absolutely. Raffensperger, you know, is an engineer. He's a principled guy. He's a Republican, but somebody who's defended Georgia's voting system and the way the votes are counted and the way the system worked. And, I mean, he and his staff told the president that the facts weren't there and the numbers weren't there and that, you know, he lost and he should accept that loss.
So we're also hearing today from Raffensperger's deputy, Gabriel Sterling. Because as President Trump was criticizing Georgia's election, Sterling was the one who warned in December 2020 in a very emotional statement that someone is going to get killed. What can you tell us about that?
Well, right. Sterling was the public face of Georgia's election results, holding numerous press conferences, pushing back on the absurd claims, the somewhat legitimate claims, and really just being the arbiter of truth in telling people, no, this is what really happened with Georgia's elections. And a lot of the negative consequences from these claims resulted in election workers getting death threats, people being followed, people's names being published. And actually, one of the people we'll hear from as well is a former Fulton County, Georgia election worker who was named, along with her mother, as two people that committed treason and somehow overturned the election by altering results, that faced racist death threats. And Sterling was really one of the biggest voices to push back against Republicans like President Trump, who were just pushing these claims.
One of the big questions here is what will happen next? Because outside of these hearings, Fulton County is conducting a special grand jury investigation to see if the former president, Donald Trump, or others violated any state laws in this effort to overturn the election. What is the state of that investigation?
Well, Peter, as we speak, there are people testifying to this grand jury, answering to subpoenas. Today, we're expected to hear from Attorney General Chris Carr about calls that he had with former President Trump, as well as investigations into fraud and things. Most of the people that have testified so far have kept mum about what they've said, but we do know a lot about this investigation. Fulton County District Attorney Fonnie Willis has asked for a lot of documents and a lot of conversations with people because this wasn't just some one-off event. This was weeks and weeks and weeks of a pressure campaign that ultimately failed, but still could have wide-ranging repercussions.
Stephen Fowler, I know it's a very busy day for the state of Georgia and politics. Your beat, thank you very much for making some time for us today. Appreciate it.
Always a pleasure.
Well, that infamous call from then-President Trump to the Georgia Secretary of State demanding he find the votes to overturn the election results and declare Trump the winner. Is that a smoking gun? Evidence that could lead to federal charges from the Department of Justice? And where are we in historical context for such a thing? Julian Zelizer is professor of history and public affairs at Princeton. He helps us look at news through an historical prism. Hi, Julian.
Hi, nice to be with you.
You too. And Attorney General Merrick Garland made a surprise trip to Ukraine today. He's meeting with government officials there about prosecuting war crimes against Vladimir Putin and Russia. Now, you know, there's been fear from Democrats that his department may not pursue any charges against Donald Trump here at home. What are the things you think Garland is weighing?
Well, first, he's weighing the evidence. He would only do this if it's a case without any serious doubt that he could be successful. And I'm not sure he's reached that conclusion yet. And obviously, congressional hearings are different than a court process. But politically, it's a big step. And I think what we're hearing is Garland is reluctant to establish a precedent whereby the incumbent administration prosecutes a former president, including a former president who might be running again, meaning a political opponent. And I think his concern is, in a polarized era, opening the door to this kind of action versus the need for accountability.
Well, give us some historical perspective for a president out of office facing charges and the other party being in office at the time. We know that that has never happened before, but remind us what happened with Nixon, because he was followed by the Republican Gerald Ford.
Well, that's when we got closest, and President Ford famously, in September of 1974, pardoned Nixon for the crimes he might have committed. And so it never moved forward to the place many Americans thought it would go, meaning into the courts. And in that case, Ford made the decision that the needs for accountability were less important than the political dangers that could result in the president being prosecuted in court. And then when Bill Clinton stepped down, there was also a deal that was made to prevent the investigation from continuing after his impeachment and the end of his presidency. So we haven't been in this exact place. It's been stopped both times.
Right. And you know, you said the consideration might be of the politics of it, how it might look. Is there a concern also about a violent reaction? Does he weigh that? Because we saw January 6th.
Of course. And it's more than how it might look. I think the thing Garland is thinking about is, yes, first, what kind of reaction might this result in, both if it's successful, violence or more. If it's not successful, if he would prosecute and it's not successful, it could establish a standard where you can get away with this. But he's also just worried politically. Look, we are in an era of escalating partisan warfare. Garland, who's cautious, is just worried, what happens next time around? What happens if the former president is reelected? Could you see this happen again? And those are the concerns I suspect are haunting Garland as he watches the hearings and tries to make this decision.
A pretty tough position to be in.
Absolutely. And the hearings are both revealing in how far this effort went to overturn the election, but also in how close we got to the Department of Justice being totally politicized, meaning being part of an effort to overturn the election. A few different people in place, this could have looked very different. So Garland has seen both sides of the stories unfold in the same hearings.
And we've seen recent reporting about how there was an attempt within the Department of Justice by people within the Department of Justice to get somebody sympathetic to Donald Trump just days before January 6th, sympathetic to the claim, the lies, to be heading that department, came very close. Look, you know, we don't live in a time when all Americans are glued to the Watergate hearings as they were in the 70s. There are networks not even covering it, featuring hosts that are perpetrating the lie. A swath of the country believes the lie. You've spoken about Merrick Garland, but speak for yourself. How, as an historian, are you viewing this? Do you think we're marching inexorably, you know, to another January 6th?
Yes. I mean, look, the findings are really stunning, and it's hard to just step back as a historian or as any other professional and say, look, an effort was underway by the person in power and members of his administration to literally overturn the election. It was systematic. January 6th was just one piece of the puzzle. So what you see in the hearings is how close they got to being successful. Or you could easily imagine how this could have unfolded in a different way. And if this just becomes part of our political vocabulary, meaning this can happen, that's a dangerous place for the democracy to be. So I don't know what Garland is going to do, but somehow we do need our democracy to be in a better place. So this is simply out of the realm of possibility.
Yeah, and that things like, you know, accountability are somehow had. But, you know, as you say that, yes, you think we're marching. Has there been another time in history where this many Americans, in the few seconds we have believed something that's not true?
Well, look, we've had terrible moments of breakdown like the Civil War, but that doesn't mean this is a better place. And so, no, we are in a place where large parts of the population believe untrue things and believe them as things that you could even run on politically. And that is not healthy for any of us.
Julian Zelizer, Professor of History and Public Affairs at Princeton. Julian, thanks as always.
Thanks for having me.
The federal government is in the process of accounting for one of the darkest chapters in this country's history. For 150 years, Native American children were forced from their homes and sent away to boarding schools. Last month, the Department of the Interior released the first of several reports that documented the history of these schools and the cultural annihilation the children experienced there. It also found 53 burial sites on campuses across the United States. Interior Secretary Deb Haaland is the first Native person to serve in a cabinet position. She recently told NPR why the government was operating or supporting more than 400 boarding schools between the years of 1819 and 1969.
They had already committed genocide against the Indians, and they worked very hard to kill as many off as they could, but it was impossible to kill them all off. So finally, it was thought if they can take the children away from their families, assimilate them, turn them essentially into white people, then they wouldn't have that problem anymore.
47 of those schools were in the state of Arizona, and the most prominent was right here in the capital. The Phoenix Indian School opened in 1891 and didn't close until nearly a century later in 1990. Now, one thing to know about Phoenix Indian is that the campus is right here in the heart of central Phoenix. I can see the tall buildings of downtown right in front of me. And these cars that you can hear zooming past, they are driving on Indian School Road. Ask anyone in town and they'll tell you they've driven down it 1,000 times. But if you ask them why it has that name, my guess is they would have no idea about the traumatic history they are driving right past.
There's a big round sidewalk, and it's called the Circle of Life.
Molita Yazzi knows that history well. She runs the school's visitor center, and she's showing me what's left of the campus. It's a hot June afternoon. The trees don't offer enough shade on the sidewalk. Even the gurgling fountain seems thirsty.
That building there is the Memorial Hall. So these three buildings were the only three buildings of the whole campus that are still standing.
Oh, really? So yeah. A lot came down?
Yeah. Yeah. It's gone.
Yazzi shows me the old dining hall. It's gorgeous. One-story red brick. Looks like an old mission built 120 years ago. I tap on the window and peer inside. There's an old sink and a broken stove.
There's holes in the ceiling there.
Yeah.
But it's interesting because you can kind of just, it feels like time kind of stopped inside there, doesn't it?
Yeah. All these bricks laying. Look at those heavy doors on this side, on the right side.
Do you sometimes imagine what it would have been like?
Yeah, I can just hear the echo and slamming of dishes, children talking.
In the early days, the children who used this dining hall were forced to wear military uniforms. The unfamiliar food they ate made them sick. Their hair was cut short. Their indigenous names erased.
They just looked at you and said, your name is John. And your birth date is February 10th.
According to a local museum, the Indian commissioner traveled to Phoenix in 1890 and said it was cheaper to educate Indians than to kill them. By the turn of the century, Phoenix Indian was home to about 700 students. Up to 20 of them would try to run away every month. There was a posse in charge of finding them. It's hard not to think about the children who suffered here as we walk this path that represents the circle of life. And yet, there are signs that children played here. Yazzie shows me the eastern facade of Memorial Hall. Over the years, hundreds of students have etched their names into the soft red brick.
1952.
Ed.
Some of them have their nicknames on there. It's Boney.
Boney.
I can't deny it. There's the evidence carved in brick.
Well, you were a teenager. We'll forgive you.
Yeah, defacing government property, but who cares, right?
Patty Talahongva lived on campus in 1978.
And my sister, Rosalie, her name, she carved her name in the brick, but she won't own up to it.
Talahongva is Hopi. She spent her junior year at Phoenix Indian. Her mother had a tough choice to make. Talahongva's father had just died, and there wasn't room in a small apartment for all the kids. So Patty and her sister had to move more than 100 miles away.
The day we arrived, there were Trailways buses and Greyhound buses, bumper to bumper to bumper, all of the students. Mm. And people were getting out and, you know, hugging each other and happy to be back together. And it was chaotic.
It's important to know that Phoenix Indian was a very different place by the time Talahongva arrived. Reforms to native schools began slowly in the 1920s after a scathing report highlighted the atrocities and the dismal education happening there. In 1978, Talahongva could dress however she wanted. I could see she had style as we flipped through her yearbook.
There I am.
Oh, there you are.
With really long bangs.
I was just going to say, I love your bangs.
Oh, my goodness.
It was the late 70s. What are you going
to
do?
Yeah, well, they needed to be feathered more.
Talahongva remembers remnants of the school's military history. The students had to buff the floors and make their beds with military precision. But she also liked it there and made friends from tribes she didn't know much about before.
Oh, those Apaches with their headbands. They were a lot of fun. Ute Mountain Utes, they had their powwow drum, and they would set it out on the campus, and you could hear that drum all over. Mm. So when I came to school at Phoenix Indian, the government had finally decided that it wasn't good to suppress the language. So culture was very much embraced when I went to school there. But that only came about after decades of harsh treatment, just totally trying to wipe out the culture. And finally, you know, they realized, okay, that's not working.
Help me understand that. How did it go from these places that suppressed the culture to a community where you could celebrate it and, in fact, share your culture with each other?
It was not just at the boarding schools, but, you know, just think about the tone of the country and things, how things were changing with the African-American population. And that kind of brought the Native American population along, too. And the other thing is, some of these students, they still went to college. They exceeded the expectations of the boarding school and went off and got their education and then came back. That change helped shape the direction of the schools.
I understand there was a program where people from the community, from the city, would come onto campus and they would hire you for odd jobs. Anybody could come and do this. What was that about?
Yeah, just what you said. It's well documented that the schools were meant to produce a cheap labor force. It was called the Phoenix Indian Industrial School. We were looked at as cheap labor.
Did you go out?
Yeah, I went out too. Girls got housekeeping and boys got yard work.
In the context of all this, I wonder what your thoughts are on the conversation that we have been having around the country, not only in this country, actually, but in Canada as well, where we've been, the rest of us have been learning the history about the unmarked graves and some of the atrocities that happened on these campuses over the many, many decades that they've been in existence. What do you think about all that?
Well, for us in Indian country, you know, we know the history of the boarding schools because we've lived it. And we know that so many kids never came home. And we know they died at the schools. What happened to them? The rest of the world is finally catching up to what we've known for decades. And I would put it back to you and just say, really think about if this happened to your grandparents. You know that an aunt or uncle died at a boarding school and they were never returned home. Mm. How do you have closure? And especially if you have ceremonies that you're supposed to do when someone passes away to take care of them for the next world, and you never get that opportunity. It's just awful.
And yet, as far as we know, there's no official record of grave sites at this campus. Should they be looking?
Oh, absolutely.
But the question is, where? Today, most of the campus is a city park. I asked a spokesperson if they'd ever searched for human remains. The answer was no. The city's archaeologist has seen no evidence of a cemetery. But Molita Yazzie says there is an obvious place to look.
So, right here in this area, right here, in this corner, is where the hospital used to be for the school.
We're standing in front of a dirt lot, fenced off, full of weeds.
There's nothing there right now, and I think with Deb Holland's initiative, this piece of land here is going to come into contention sooner or later because it was a hospital.
Which means people may have died in that
potentially,
area.
Potentially, yeah. Very, very possible. We don't know, but it's possible.
Over the course of 100 years,
yeah.
Possible, probably, likely.
Yeah.
The owner of this small parcel is a private real estate developer. I called and emailed. No one returned my messages. In the 1990s, a researcher named Owen Lindauer led an excavation at a different site on campus. They unearthed artifacts like buttons and glass. Lindauer told me they also found plenty of bones, but none of them human. He also said there's no doubt children died here, but his research shows the bodies were either sent home or buried in a city cemetery. For Melita Yazzie, who is Navajo, it is almost too much to bear.
You can only imagine, you know, what the children went through. Pass away not being with your family, you know. So that's what I think of. It's hard. How could this have happened, you know?
The Interior Department investigation into Native boarding schools is ongoing. Last month's report says it expects to find more grave sites on campuses across the country. Whether anyone will search at Phoenix Indian is unclear. Israel's prime minister is stepping down after just 1 year in office. His governing coalition was falling apart, and now Israelis will head to the polls again for the fifth time in over 3 years. This has major implications for Israel's democracy as Benjamin Netanyahu tries to return to power to form a right-wing nationalist government. NPR's Daniel Estrin joins us now from Tel Aviv. Daniel, hi.
Hi, Peter.
So when this coalition government formed last year, it was historic. Why didn't it succeed? Why did it fail?
Yeah, it was historic. It was Israel's most diverse governing coalition ever. 8 different parties, left to right, even an Arab party helped form the coalition for the first time. And they wanted to be a model. They wanted to prove that Israelis of all stripes can put aside their differences on the most difficult issues like the Israeli-Palestinian conflict so that they can find common ground on the day-to-day issues. This partnership was led by right-wing Prime Minister Naftali Bennett and centrist Foreign Minister Yair Lapid. I spoke to Lapid's former strategic advisor, Ayelet Frisch, and she told me that this partnership did not work.
From the very beginning, the Lapid-Bennett government didn't have a real chance. The government entered a stage where it couldn't pass legislation or get anything done. It was completely stuck.
What happened was some Jewish nationalists and some Arab lawmakers began turning their backs on this partnership. They disagreed on some of Israel's thorniest issues, like settlers in the occupied West Bank, and that's why this fell apart.
Now the question is, what kind of opportunity does this give the former Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu? Could he return to power?
He could. A poll today shows that Benjamin Netanyahu and his right-wing allies have the advantage in this upcoming race. But they don't have enough support to form their own government, it appears. So the question is if Netanyahu will be able to break the political stalemate. In the next few months, we're going to see a lot of new alliances formed between smaller political parties. And the idea is that they're going to try to create a strong bloc that will prevent Netanyahu from taking office again.
And what major issues does the country face now as it faces down yet another election?
Well, one major question is, what would a Netanyahu comeback look like? Will he give important positions to far-right figures who have gained a lot of popularity among his base in the past year? Also, Netanyahu stands trial for corruption. Could he, if he's in office, weaken the justice system to protect himself? That's something that analysts are asking. We're going to also probably see a very heated debate in these elections about the role of Arab citizens in political life. As I said, an Arab party helped form a coalition for the first time in Israel's history. Now that coalition has collapsed, and Netanyahu is even calling that Arab party a supporter of terror. So a big question, will Arabs and Jews in Israel conclude that the integration of Arab leaders into politics just doesn't work or isn't worth it? That's a very big question for the future of Israeli democracy.
NPR's Daniel Estrin is reporting from Tel Aviv. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
This warning, our next conversation might be difficult to hear because we're going to talk about a time before birth control and the lengths women went to end pregnancies. With so much attention focused on Roe v. Wade and whether the Supreme Court will strike down the 1973 ruling granting a right to end a pregnancy, you'd be forgiven for forgetting, or maybe not even knowing, about the case from the year before, 1972, that legalized birth control to prevent pregnancies and paved the way for Roe. It was called Eisenstadt versus Baird, and the court ruled that all women, not just married women, had the right to birth control. Yes, prior to that, only married women had that right. The Baird in Eisenstadt v. Baird was Bill Baird, a distributor of new birth control devices like foam and condoms. He became maybe the only male reproductive rights activist to be arrested and jailed, beaten many times. He's now turning 90, and this is still his life's calling. That is correct, right, Bill?
Would you believe I've been doing this for 60 years, and I'm so excited to speak with you today to spend my birthday, because I grew up quite poor in the Great Depression, and to think that 90 years later, someone still cares if I'm alive or dead or what my views are. So thank you so much.
Let's just remind people, you were jailed 8 times in 5 different states going back to the 60s for displaying, discussing, and distributing birth control. For people who are saying, no way, talk about how dangerous that was.
Well, it was. When you think I began way back in 1963, I was clinical director for a manufacturer of the foam. And I was at Harlem Hospital talking about the research on the drug, and I heard a scream. And like anybody else, I raced into the hallway at Harlem Hospital, and I saw this young Black woman stagger in, and I caught her because I knew she was going to hit the floor. And I held her in my arms, and she murmured something about her 9 children. And then I noticed she was covered with blood from the waist down, as if somebody had thrown a can of red paint on her. And I saw this piece of coat hanger sticking out of her body. And as I held her, she gave her last gasp, and she died. And I grieved because she could not get birth control. It was against the law for unmarried women, but also she could not get an abortion. But she had the money. She could have gone down the street to wealthy hospitals, and with the right connections, she could have been alive and lived. And I grieved to that day because I grew up very poor. My sister died when I was only 9. She had appendicitis, and we didn't know what it was, just she was screaming in pain, and we didn't have the money for a doctor, and her appendix broke. Nobody should die because they're too poor. This was the same condition with this woman and her children without a mother.
Yeah. Well, so the direct line from your childhood, during the Depression, a violent home, your dad beat your mom. Your mom didn't have enough food for 6 kids. You had another sibling who died from a lack of ability to care. You know, you can draw a direct line from losing your own siblings to that woman, a terrible image, Bill Baird, in your arms. And again, for people gasping, this is what happened. I mean, women resorted to hangers or back alley doctors.
Robin, women used to take douching bags and fill them with Lysol or bleach or turpentine. Yeah. But most times what people would do, they would take a baster that you use at Thanksgiving time, fill it with a saline solution, like a cup of water with a couple of tablespoons of salt, shove it inside the cervix of the uterus, and by squeezing it, they would not only squeeze the water that could perhaps induce a miscarriage, but would also induce air. And you could die in those days. It was called an air embolism.
Yeah. Again, this is so difficult for people to hear, but this was the world, not just pre-abortion choice, but pre-birth control. So here you are suddenly selling these very early forms of birth control. Yeah. You bought a cheap UPS truck. You painted the words Parents Aid Society on it, which you had formed. And you went out to try to educate women about birth control, what was available.
I would go into well-known poverty areas, and I would send out literature ahead of time. And they were so eager. The van would be filled time and time again.
You also knew the police would come. And to have legal standing in a case as a man, the only way you could be part of the case was to have broken the law, which you did, and arrested, beaten in jail several times. Bill Baird, what do you say to people today who say, it is awful that your mom had no choice of birth control and was in an abusive relationship and had children die? But then they might also say, we do have birth control now, thanks in part to you. If she had chosen birth control, the world wouldn't have had you. But also, because you helped bring birth control to so many, maybe there's less of a need for abortions and a law permitting it.
Well, another way of looking at it is that my mother, instead of having six children, may have had one or two or three, and therefore been able to give the children more. And I had the belief that children should be born into a family loved and wanted, and we were hardly loved and wanted.
What would you say if the court does overturn Roe v. Wade?
I have to word this so carefully because it's hard for me to be diplomatic, because way back in 1972, that's the year of Baird versus Eisenstein, the headline said, Baird predicts abortion will be legal in 1 year. 1 year. And what happened? 1 year later, abortion was legal. Then what do you think the headline said then? The headline said, Baird warns, fight is not over. I had predicted that the Catholic Church in particular would organize and later would unite with evangelicals to unite and form a mighty force of, quote, moral crusaders based on their religious values, which to me have no place in a general society. I use the analogy, and I hope somebody will hear me. Jehovah Witnesses would never try to pass a law banning blood transfusions. Orthodox Jews don't ban a law preventing you and I from eating ham and eggs because they're opposed to pork.
Well, Bill Baird, I mean, you're 90 years old. From the sounds, I think you're going to be around for quite a while kicking.
I'm fighting for 100. What do you think of that?
But you immediately went to that woman from however many decades ago in that hospital dying in your arms. You know, and she wasn't the only one you saw. How are you feeling about this?
I grieve in my heart of soul because, you know, if they only would have listened to me. I was a realist. I could see when I went to these conventions, the Right to Life convention, they would say, fertilized eggs are people, soul enters a conception, and they would believe it. I see grown-up people now, legislators, today, saying on network television, fertilized eggs are people.
Mm. Well, we're reminded that one of your arrests was when you were demonstrating, I think it was, there was a birth control pill and a diaphragm.
Yes.
And there was a woman in the audience who was holding a 14-month-old baby.
Of all my battles, I will tell you what you just said. It was one of my most painful. I gave a speech in Huntington, Long Island, and then all of a sudden I heard a woman scream. A young mother holding a baby was being handcuffed by the police, being arrested. I said, what are you doing? They said, we're charging you with a crime of endangering the morals of a minor, a 14-month baby, they said, saw birth control devices and could get sexual ideas. Now, this is a baby. You got to be stark raving nuts. And they brought the charges against the mother and I. Both of us faced 3 years in prison. And, of course, I won the case. But my four little children, small kids, we got mail at home that my children would be murdered. And my first wife said, I'm out of here. And I understood that. And she moved hundreds of miles away, basically in hiding. And I was close with my kids growing up. But when they grew up, they kind of didn't like the idea that their father brought about a lot of attention that they really didn't want. And I didn't try to have it, but that's how the anti-abortion people think. And it's sad. because they say they're pro-life, but killing me is not.
Lots of sacrifice. Speak to men right now.
I would say to men, look, there's something in medicine called a maternal death rate. Women die of childbirth, toxemia of pregnancy, the uterus can rupture. Lots of things can go wrong. What's the death rate for us men in a waiting room? Zero. Men are not very brave because we did the vasectomies also. Well, can you imagine a doctor putting a curette into the uterus and trying to abort her? And we're going to say to legislators, male legislators, essentially, that you're going to dictate to women what their freedom should be, what their life should be? How dare you have the arrogance to do that? So I suggest to men, if you don't want to see women organize and make vasectomies a crime and you go to jail for it, you would find very quickly no man would want that, and no man should ever support, or any woman should ever support, another human being told how to maintain their lifestyle or their pregnancy.
Bill Baird, his 1972 legal challenge cleared the way for single women to get birth control and paved the way for 1973's Roe v. Wade. Bill, thanks so much.
Thank you so much.
With a green light from the CDC, families across the country are booking COVID vaccine appointments for their little ones under the age of 5. But if you are a parent in Florida, you may have to hold off just a little while longer. That's because under Republican Governor Ron DeSantis, pediatricians were prevented from pre-ordering vaccines from the federal government until just last Friday. Dr. Lisa Gwynn leads the Florida chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics. Welcome to the show, Dr. Gwynn.
Thank you so much.
So every other state in the country was able to get their orders in for these shots before yours. What does that mean for families with young kids in Florida?
Well, it means that we just may have to wait a little bit longer before the vaccines become available to all of us. But I will tell you that the good news for our clinics is we actually received our vaccines early this morning. So we are in a situation that we never imagined we would be in. We actually have vaccines in hand.
Is this a mere inconvenience, or do you think that there's a way in which this affects the health of young children in your state?
So last week, I had a different answer than this week. Okay, last week, we weren't sure whether or not, number one, we would be able to place orders. There was some initial concern that we couldn't place orders. And then when it was clarified that, in fact, we could place orders, then we weren't sure when we would be receiving them because we were the last out of the 50 states to place those orders. This week, it's a whole different ballgame. It does look like we will have vaccines in our offices. The challenge now is going to be, since we weren't really able to pre-plan that much, now practices are going to have to plan on when they will be able to bring in all of those children to get them vaccinated because there is logistics involved with this series.
There's a few bigger picture issues going on here. The state of Florida is not offering the vaccines through its state or local health departments, and the health department does not even recommend COVID-19 vaccines for healthy young children, which of course goes against the CDC guidance. When you step back and think about the picture across the entire state of Florida, what is the environment like for doctors that are following the science?
It's been a very challenging life walk that we walk in the medical community over the last couple of years. It really has been challenging. Never before has our profession been under such challenges from those in politics. And we don't work in the political world. We take care of patients. We want to do what's best for our patients. We spend many, many years of schooling and training to be able to be ready to provide our patients with the best possible care that's, you know, scientifically proven. And so to have our industry be challenged in such a way, especially in the vaccine world, because vaccines have been the greatest public health accomplishment of this century. And we have never had such a problem or such pushback from vaccines. So it's been really, really challenging. And, you know, really at the end of the day, we just want to do what's best for our patients and to allow us to have access to vaccines so that we can make those choices and parents and patients can make those choices for ourselves.
I'm thinking about access. You know, if Florida doesn't offer vaccines through state and local health departments, what options do parents have if they don't have insurance or if they live in a place where it's hard to get to the doctor?
This is what's so confusing to us, is that, so if you are over five, you can go to a local health department and get a COVID vaccine. But if you're 4 years old, you cannot. And there hasn't been any scientific reason for that decision. And so we are faced with, yes, we're faced with an equity issue. Those children that are most marginalized, that don't have access to a medical home, are now not, they're, I'm not really sure how they're going to be able to access those vaccines other than through, there are federally qualified health centers that offer the vaccine, but they're not going to be able to serve everybody that, you know, the demand. It's, they're just not set up that way. We do have other options, such as mobile clinics that go into underserved communities. But what I'm most concerned about are these smaller practices, especially in rural and you know, locations where there isn't a lot of access, that they won't have that option to go to their local health department.
Despite some of these challenges, you say you got your shipment this morning, right? Are you getting those shots into arms as of today?
Well, we were pleasantly surprised today. I'm going to say it's going to take us about 48 hours to get all of our teams, you know, planned. And we're hoping by the end of the week we'll have shots in arms.
No matter when that happens, it must be such a relief to you and to the families who've been waiting for more than 2 years for this opportunity.
Yes, yes. We are so thrilled. Our mobile units and our school health clinics are in underserved communities. And so we're going to do our very best to get as many shots in arms as possible.
Dr. Lisa Gwynn heads up the Florida chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics. Doctor, thank you for your time.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Peter O'Dowd in Phoenix.
I'm Robin Young in Boston. It's Here and Now.